Hi, Sue Hall here, and welcome to the fifth podcast in our fourth series of Talking the Dis Out of Dyslexia, hosted by the Whole Dyslexic Society. On March 27th, 2021, TEDx Bear Creek Park live streamed 12 talks, and I was privileged to be one of the speakers. Our guest today is Isabelle Mercier, one of the most inspirational branding, marketing, and customer experience keynote speakers. Isabelle is a no-nonsense dynamo, born to catapult passionate entrepreneurs and thought leaders to build businesses and brands designed to make life better. As one of North America's top business influencers, best-selling author, two-time TEDx speaker with over 2.7 million views, and TV show host, Isabelle brings over 25 years of branding, marketing, and consumer experience expertise. She has helped thousands of business owners and thought leaders, as well as some influential and iconic brands like A&W, Ruby's Footwear, Earl's Restaurants, IMAX Corporation, and HSBC Investments, just to name a few. Isabelle teaches how to grow businesses and brands that are designed to thrive in any economy by becoming and remaining the first, the best, or the only. So welcome, Isabelle. That is an impressive resume.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. You know, first of all, congratulations for your recent TED Talk, TEDx Talk. It was, as you know, a subject that is very near and dear to my heart. So it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much. Now, why don't you tell us a little bit of how you actually got to be where you are? Maybe how did you get to deliver a TEDx in the first place? What did you want to tell everybody about?
I didn't. That's the thing. You know, so here's what happened. For 3 years in a row, I was asked, particularly asked to do a TEDx. So my first TEDx, I did not have to go through the hoops of applying. And I did not want to do a TEDx. I know how much work goes into that. Also, experiencing dyslexia in my life, I knew that it was going to be quite the mountain to climb. And I didn't have time, and it wasn't on my bucket list. You know how it's on many people's bucket list.
It was on my bucket list.
It certainly was not on mine. But I had a massive goal at the time. This is 5 years ago, I think, 2016. I had a big goal of impacting 1 million entrepreneurs. Well, 1 million people to begin with. And I thought to myself at the third year when they asked me again, why am I keeping saying no? Is it because I'm scared? Or is it because I simply don't want one? But listen, I am a speaker. My goal is to impact millions of people. So then I thought, oh, this would be a little bit of a shortcut to impacting that many people. So why don't I say yes? But I will say it was quite the endeavor. It was a process that nearly killed me initially on my first one. I honestly didn't think I was going to survive it.
Oh my gosh, that is incredible. So maybe we should backtrack a little bit and go to this world that you grew up in, which was a very dyslexic world. Maybe we should give people a little back history on that one.
Yes, nobody knew that there was the dyslexia in me. It wasn't a very popular thing where I live. Nobody really knew about it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't easily diagnosed. I was an A student, yet problematic student. Because I was always asking questions. I was known as the disruptor. I'm still known as the disruptor, but for business and growth instead of, but still same label. Because I was always asking questions, I was going, oh, what is that? A little bit like even music. I can play anything by ear. If I know what the sound is and what it looks like on the page, I know. So in music, I would always say to my teacher, can you hum it for me? Hum it so that I can visually see what the beat is, and then I would know it and I would just go for it.
I would love to be able to do that.
Yeah, and I can pretty much play any instrument.
Amazing, wow.
But that's the thing, is I was the disturber. Some teachers would say, why do you always want the attention? I don't want the attention, I want to understand. That's what I want. I was always sitting in the front, asking questions. The worst thing for me in school was when, in my days, they would have you read out loud. Oh, terrible.
Yeah.
And so what I would do is I would count the students, and then I'd count the paragraphs, and I'd practice my paragraph.
They still do that.
Yeah, but then you know what happened? Natalie in front of me was a great reader. So Natalie would read 2-3 paragraphs. Then now I had practiced the wrong one. Now, meanwhile, it's not like I was listening. I wasn't learning. I was just petrified to not look and feel like I'm a complete moron or idiot, right? Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, I have created thousands of ways, and I know I'm not the only one. I know you understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I've created a whole bunch of ways to sound and look intelligent and to not lose the train of things. And I found ways to study, and my TEDx script is divided in 8 sections, and they all have icons in front of them so that I knew what goes after what.
Yeah,
I can't say I had a bad childhood. I had a great childhood. I loved school. I loved learning. Thank God I was a curious George. Mm-hmm. But, I've had some teachers that were painful and difficult. Meanwhile, they thought I was painful and difficult. And then I've had some really awesome teachers that were curious, that wanted to know how I saw, what I saw, how I understood, because I always had a no, you know, the square is not protruding. It's going the other way. No, the shadow doesn't go that way. I see it. It goes this way.
Perfect.
I was a bit of a phenomenon.
I think that's fantastic. And to have some teachers who were able to work with you on that is a blessing for sure.
One of them in particular was absolutely a blessing. Thank God for this teacher. And she's no longer on this earth right now, but literally she was a godsend. She took the time, she understood me. And the moment that she explained things, so she would often explain for everybody and then go, hey, Isabel, for you, it would be blah, blah, blah. But then eventually she realized that if she just explained it for me, to everybody, everybody understood it faster because it was more visual, more, not everybody, because not everybody is a visual learner, but there was a lot less of, and for you, Isabel. And at some point I would reiterate, I'm a great reiterator. And if someone says something and I can feel what they're saying, I can feel what they're not saying. And I have plenty of bravery and audacity to actually say what is not being said, but is being wanting to be said. So in school, if a student didn't understand, and often the teacher would re-explain the same way, and I was like, well, that's a bit of an insanity. So I would lift my hand and go, here's how I see it. And then blah, 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 blah. And then everybody, even the people who understood, they understood better.
You see, you're playing right into my hands because this is how I think our education system should change. There are so many more people who think like you and I do. Some of them go under the radar, some of them get tested. But I know that if things are explained in a way that you and I understand, with plenty of visuals and maybe some hands-on and that type of thing, the whole class benefits. It's like our system is the one size fits all almost, whereas we're stuck in this system with the sound-based thinking, which is not one size fits all. But I have to tell you a quick story. My son happened to be particularly good at math. He has dyslexia. And there was a math teacher in his high school class who would explain things to the class, and everybody would sit there thinking, what is she talking about? George would get it. I don't know how he got it, but he got it. And she would say to him, George, come up the front and tell everybody what I've said.
Yeah, I totally get it. I totally get it. And for me, math was terrible because to me, if there's a math equation, the teacher would always say, Isabel, stop tripping over the flowers of the carpet. Because I was like, why do we need to do what's in the parentheses first? But why is the parentheses so far? Just put it in order. How about that? You know?
We have a different logic system, right?
Yes.
And when things are not logical, they're just not logical. End of story. It does not make sense. One thing I remember, you know, that negative and positive number thing, that they call it a number line. And I think you have 0 in the middle. And I think you have negative on the left-hand side and positive on the right-hand side. And that makes no sense to me whatsoever. It should be the other way around, because bigger numbers are on the left and smaller numbers are on the right.
I hear you. Yeah, there's little things that just either help us propel us forward, or the complete opposite gets us to seclude and not understand. And for me, the reason why I was labeled as the little shit disturber because I was vocal about it. I've always been vocal about what I understand, what I don't understand, what makes sense to me, what doesn't make sense to me. Why that? Why this? How come? Whereas some people will go quiet when they don't understand something. I go vocal when I don't understand something.
That's so funny. That's beautiful. How did the other kids react? Were they grateful that you were able to stir things up a little bit?
Yeah. Even to this day, there are things that I explain that people go, oh my God, thank God. Isabel, when you speak, we get it. I have analogies. I have great analogies for explaining things. And I always find analogies to explain anything because analogies always win, right? Always. Whether you're dyslexic or not, whether you're visual or not, an analogy cannot be not effective. And so, yes, you know, people often they would say, go ask Isabel. She'll simplify it for you.
All this was in French?
This was in French, correct.
Would that be more difficult, do you think, or easier?
French is way harder for me than English. I speak French really well, but it's because French has so many rules. It has like exceptions coming out of everywhere. So unless you really understand all the exceptions, if I spell something, my partner, Margarita, she's been bilingual for her entire life. She went to immersion in kindergarten. But I didn't. I was French until I was 20, and then I learned English. And she would say, why do you spell this way and you spell this that way? I go, I just know. You know, I know there's a rule. I don't know the rule. I just know that it's that, you know, yes. French has masculine, feminine. It has a bunch of different things that like, why is a table feminine? Why is a car masculine? I don't know why. I just know that they are.
Well, exactly. Why did they even have to be masculine or feminine in the first place?
I know. So there's an accent. Like English is a simple language to me. Although there are words that are the exact same word, but they mean the exact opposite. So that's a bit confusing. But comparatively to the complexity of French, English is way easier.
Very true. So you got through school, you graduated, you went to university?
I went to university. So I was French, 100% purebred French. Did not speak any other language. And then I go and throw myself into an English university. I like to give myself some challenges.
You're up for challenges, that's for sure.
So I had to learn English lickety split. And I had a teacher, first of all, he had a UK accent, which I did not understand, let alone understand English, let alone another accent. Mm. And he kept saying, so on, so forth, so on, so forth, and so on, so forth. That was his thing. He kept saying that. But I heard that as a sound, right? To me, that was a repetitive sound. And this is where I met my wife. Margaret was bilingual since birth, and she could file her nails, listen to the teacher, and explain things to me all at once. She was that bright. And I was like, wow, I can't even read this paragraph, you know? And I'm like, what is he saying all the time? And she's like, what? What? Because she understands what he's saying. I'm like, that sound. She's like, oh, that's an expression, so on and so forth, you know? So yeah, I had to learn English, and I was in theater scenography school with Shakespeare.
Whoa, that's another challenge.
Honestly, I spent my first year crying.
Oh, I can believe it. Oh my goodness. Shakespeare is not easy for English people, let alone people who are not.
I was always like, can't he speak like everybody else? What does that mean? Oh my God, it was so difficult. But I found a job at a hospital, Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal, that I was going to Concordia University in Montreal. I worked at the hospital with English doctors and nurses. Everything was complicated for me in university.
Yet
I ended with a 4.0 GPA average, and I worked my butt off. And here I am today, fully bilingual, minus a few words here and there. Sometimes I'm not even bilingual in French now anymore because I've been speaking English for so long.
Wow. So what was your degree? It was, did you say cinematography?
Cinematography. So it was set design for movies and theater.
Brilliant. Wow, you must have enjoyed that. That's where your gift kicks in, right? When you have this beautiful imagination.
Oh yeah, I was a dancer when I was younger. I've always been in art. So before university, I did a 3-year degree in college for graphic design and marketing and all of that. So.
Wow, one talented lady. My goodness. It's no wonder you've got to where you've got.
Sometimes I wonder though. Sometimes I'm like, why am I here? What doing? Yeah.
Yes. Well, that sort of brings us to your TED Talk. So what was it you wanted to deliver to a million people?
So the first TED Talk, I wanted to talk about purpose and how to actually really nail and understand your purpose. And that was done by someone else, and we decided that was not the subject. And eventually I landed on the subject of worry, because we all worry way too much on the planet. There's a lot of worry, and worry is the number one dream killer. And I discovered when I was 9 years old, through being bullied, and I did not want to speak to a friend, not a friend, but this bully called me one night. I knew she was going to call. I'd been trying to avoid her, walking to school all day long for weeks. And when the phone rang, I knew that it was her. And I said to my mom, "I'm not here. Don't say that I'm here." And of course, my mom, what does she do? "Isabel's right here. Let me just pass her to you." And I was so mad. But she said to me that night, she goes, "Isabel, if you can't say no to what you don't want, you'll never have the time and the energy for what you do want." And I will tell you, this hit me like nothing else before. And I really took that at heart. And I started studying and noticing what drives my level of happiness up versus what drives my worry up. And I discovered that what you tolerate, you will end up worrying about. Because you can't say to someone, "Worry less." It's easy to say, not easy to do. So I wanted to share my way of thinking, which was, if you worry a lot, don't worry about the worry. Look at what you're tolerating in your life. There are things that you're tolerating. You're tolerating some people. You're tolerating that you've said yes when you should have said no. You're tolerating certain things not working in your life. A remote control that doesn't work. It doesn't matter, big or small. Those toleration will 100% of the time lead to you worrying. So if you want to reduce worry, start there. Start by looking at what you're tolerating and starting to attack what you're tolerating to automatically reduce worry. And so that was the premise of my first talk.
Brilliant. And did that lead you into your second talk?
No. Funny enough, that was done.
Yeah.
Bucket list item, not bucket listed. Done anyways. And so we went to the first Bear Creek Park TEDx event. A friend of mine was speaking on the stage, so I went to encourage her and see the lineup of speakers. And Margarita, my partner, said, so we've been in business and in life together for 30 years. She said to me, "Would you ever consider doing another TED Talk?" I looked at her like deer in the headlight. I'm like, "No, no.
Gotta be kidding."
And she said, "Well, why not? Would you consider doing one with me?" And I'm like, no. So we went to that event and she said, "Let's see if there's a sign." And so at the end of the evening, Alan, the owner of that TEDx event, says, "The next TEDx event is February 28th, 2020, which is a leap year, right? Leap February 29th. Now, my company name is Leap Zone Strategies.
There's a sign.
Every leap year has been massive for us. One of them buying this retreat center on Vancouver Island. The deal closed on February 29th of the leap year 4 years before.
Brilliant.
So we're sitting in the audience and he says, "Leap day 2020. Margarita looks at me and she goes, "There's our sign." I'm like, "God, no." And so, you know, I don't regret a thing. It was a beautiful journey. Doing it with someone is, I find, more challenging, but it was fun. We had fun with it. And I think it ended up being a really powerful talk.
Yeah.
About how to increase your units of happiness. So
that's fantastic. Going back to the worry thing, do you think worry is based in fear, though?
Worry is based in fear. It eventually leads to fear, or it can come from fear. Mm-hmm. Yet, this is why my second talk is about brave conversations. It takes bravery to reduce worry and increase units of happiness. It takes self-responsibility. And you're right, there are some things that we worry that are based on fear, but fear is not real. Fear is fabricated. Fear is when you're not in the present, you're either in the past or in the future. Here are some stats for you that are super interesting. 40% of what we worry about will never happen. It won't happen. So that would be like you putting a down payment on a house you'll never own. That's stupid. 30% of what we worry about has already happened. Nothing you can do about it, right? Nothing you can do about it. 12% of what we worry about are useless worry about our health.
Right.
Like you have a headache for 3 days and then, oh, you're worrying about a brain tumor.
Right.
And then 10% of what we worry about are piddly things like, what are we going to cook for dinner? Stuff that, of course, you have to think about, but you don't have to worry about it.
No.
And so if you calculate this, that leaves 8% for legitimate worries. 92% of what we worry about will never happen, has already happened, or is pointless.
Yeah.
So even if you tie this with fear, if you just start worrying less because you know that if I'm in the present, if I'm worrying or fearing, it's because I'm thinking of the future. As I'm sitting here, if I had a TED Talk to deliver tomorrow and I started thinking about it, my throat would be like this.
Yeah.
Why? Nothing's happening to me right now. It's because I'm already thinking about the future.
It's true. So true.
I will add one thing to this. Worrying is as ridiculous as trying to solve algebra by chewing bubble gum.
We'll leave it at that. It's a good place to stop. When you were talking about your talk, it reminded me that when I tried to memorize my talk, and as memorizing is not our thing, I was able to see the three pages that I typed my talk out onto. I could see the paragraphs, I could see the bullet points, but then I realized that there was one part that I was always forgetting. And so I drew these little images on top of the writing so that I could actually see the images as well as the design of the paragraphs. And I had to do it that way. I had to put the visual in.
And you know, the brain plays tricks on us, on me anyways, because I knew my first talk, I knew them inside and out, top to bottom, reversed, doesn't matter. You could say any word in the middle of it and I would just continue, right? I just knew it by heart. But you're right, there was always one area that was just stickier.
Yes.
So I figured out a fix for that area, except that on the real day, my memory went out in a spot that it never went out before. And I was like, how the hell can you anticipate this shit?
Yeah, it's true.
Oh, I was so mad. I'm like, come on. I knew this thing inside. I never blocked there ever. But what I had done is I had ad-libbed. I had added one sentence and I know never to do that now. But you know what? It was a 3,000 people at the Queen Elizabeth Theater Club, which was my biggest fear on the planet. Over death, it was to flub at the Queenie.
Yeah.
And it happened. And I dealt with it wonderfully. And it gave me wings. It truly gave me so much confidence for the future of how I'm delivering my talks.
Do you see many more talks in your future?
Well, I speak regularly. Will I do another TED? I don't know. Well, I know now to never say never.
Well, the funny thing was, I used to affectionately call it boot camp when we were doing all our practices. I've said this on some of the other interviews, that we were so looked after and I trusted the coaches so much that, how can I put this? It was scary, it was frightening, but at the same time, I felt looked after. So I got to the end of my talk and went off the stage. And I thought to myself, I know exactly what I'm going to talk about next time. And then I thought, how could you possibly think that? Why would you put yourself through that again?
I know.
And for weeks afterwards, I would wake up hearing my talk in my head.
I couldn't sleep for a week after. I could sleep before, although with a lot of tossing and turning and repeating the talk in my head and all that. But a week after, I was on such a high. Remember, I had busted my biggest fear in the world.
Yeah.
In addition to all the challenges that us dyslexic people experience in doing such a talk. And because I triumphed in it, I couldn't sleep for a week. I could not stop watching the talk, which I normally hate watching myself. I really do. I never rewatch anything that I do. If there's a video, I don't watch it because I'm very animated and I always do crazy faces. And God, I look like crap. So I don't look at myself, but could not stop watching it because it was such a win for me.
That was wonderful. Now, we had a slightly different experience because
yes.
we did our recorded talk and then we had the 2 weeks to wait before it went out live stream. So I wanted to be excited in those 2 weeks, but I didn't know what it was going to look like. And I knew I'd messed up four times because I went through my talk when I came home. But luckily with the camera angles, you'd never know.
That's right.
And so when it came out live stream, then it was okay to get excited.
And on top of that, you didn't experience saying your talk or delivering your talk in front of a live audience, right? So that just changes the feel of it. I mean, I had a theater filled with 3,000 people on my first talk. Before I went onto the stage, I was shaking in my boots.
I can truly believe that. I can. You now have this position where you can listen to the scripts of the people who want to become TED Talk presenters.
Yeah, so I'm on the curation team. My category is business and human rights. So we're always looking for ideas worth spreading. And yes, it's a lot of work. You have to read a lot of scripts, and the first version of a script is always a debacle. No matter how great the idea is, it's always a debacle. So we need to be able to see through the initial crap to be able to get it where it's going to be. Because even your talk has evolved, everybody's talk has evolved greatly from first
Oh,
script, right?
it was so different. But I must admit, when I realized that you had dyslexia, I just sort of kept my fingers crossed. She's got dyslexia. Maybe this will resonate
Oh, it resonated with me. It resonated with a lot of people as well, even though they didn't have dyslexia. The difficult part about the curation team is there's only 12 spots. There's like sometimes hundreds of people who apply. So at some point, you resonate with the subject, but another script is more advanced.
How do you find reading the scripts? You're pretty okay with the reading part.
So Margarita reads them out loud for me. So I follow, you remember my 4-year university? She read everything out loud for me.
Oh my, that's
Yeah.
devotion.
And then I had a better GPA than her. Oh my God, she was not happy. Even our reading, like the books that I read, that I listen to, because I do audio a lot more than reading, although I do like to follow, but Margarita reads the scripts or I read it out loud, which this used to be my nemesis as a child, reading out loud. When you read my intro earlier, I was like, wow, that's pretty good, because I don't know that I would have been able to do that.
When a typical person is reading something, they're probably hearing the sound of the words in their heads. We typically don't do that. So we have to read out loud very often to be able to do that. Sometimes we have to talk to ourselves out loud to do our thinking.
I'm an out loud processor for sure.
Yes.
For me, as I said earlier, dyslexia was the bane of my existence as a child. Today, I've learned that, my God, it is such a gift. And when I turned 40, it all kind of clicked into place when I realized that, oh, how I see things, how I understand things, how I hear things. I have a way of distilling information, so it's a little machine. Thoughts and words go into the machine, and then it comes out organized and distilled. And I do a lot of strategy sessions and strategic retreats around positioning and interrupting. Like, I teach people how to be interrupters and how to be unique and different. And they will talk for 10 minutes, blah, 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 and then I will go, here's what I got from that. Boom, boom, boom. And they're like, oh, I've never heard it or seen it this clearly. You're absolutely right. So I have this way of taking information, spitting it back out in an organized, clean, distilled, simple fashion. And then people go, my Lord, where have you been all my life? So instead of being the annoying kid that I always thought I was, now I know my genius is literally tied to this particular gift.
Amazing. I mean, you couldn't be in a better world because what are the Forbes figures for entrepreneurs having dyslexia?
Oh, I
So
don't know.
many of them have dyslexia. Richard Branson's my favorite.
Me too, actually, I have to say. And those things, those figures, right, those personalities really help as well. I'm like, wow, if you look at the most successful people on the planet, many have dyslexia. It really forced us, like this dyslexia forced me to look at things, find things, be street savvy, and have a discernment. We have a particular discernment that is actually quite rare. Now, this is now the bane of my existence because I wish more people had more common sense and a discernment. It's very frustrating to live in a world where there's very little common sense. Although common sense, you'd think it'd be common, but it's actually not. And there's a certain smart in discernment that is not common. And it's frustrating for me because that happens to be part of my genius.
For one thing, if it weren't called dyslexia, if it could be called Leonardo da Vinci syndrome, and then everybody'd be clamoring for it.
That's
I mean,
right.
We have outside the box thinking, we see the big picture. So it sort of stands to reason that we're going to come up with ideas that other people haven't come up with and see things from different angles. It's a fabulous gift. I love it. I really do. And the kids that I work with, sometimes the little guys who are athletes, they are always in the right spot on the soccer pitch. They just know where to go. And people think it's intuition. I think it's part of this gift.
Yeah.
Funny that you should say common sense, because the talk that I thought of as I left the stage this year about what I could deliver next year was, why don't we put common sense back in education? Because I see everything getting so complicated and twisted and convoluted, and the basics are going out of the window.
You're right, because a lot of what I do, working with our organizations, teams, executive teams, solopreneurs, is going back to basics. It really is. It's like, oh, let's go back to square one for a second and then sprint back. It's like a slingshot, right? In order for there to be velocity, there has to be backward motion.
Mm-hmm, that's true. Yeah.
And by the way, you have one of the best analogies. Fish don't climb trees. So true, right?
Everyone is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will grow up its whole life believing it's stupid.
This is part of my work, to come up with titles like this and differentiating sentences and snippets that are memorable. And when I saw the book title, you know, Fish Don't Climb Trees, I thought, that's a winner right there.
Well, thank you. But isn't it funny how you and I like language, and yet apparently we have this difficulty with it? I find that very interesting. I did French, English, and German for A-level, right? I love language.
Yeah, me too.
And yet we are supposed to have this difficulty. I don't think it's a difficulty with language. I think it's a difficulty with the way we're taught. So many people are such good speakers, like yourself, storytellers and musicians and lyricists.
We are a very talented bunch.
We are. Now, I've lost track of the time, but that sounds like a really good place to wind up. What would you like to leave the listeners with? Isn't it wonderful how everything that we've done in our lives always comes together to help us do what we're meant to be doing?
It's cumulative, for sure. Everything we do in our life is cumulative, and it links back in ways that we can't even predict.
Mm-hmm.
If you had said your dyslexia will be your greatest gift when I was 8 or 9, I would have actually not believed you one bit. I would have laughed at you. And now I'm like, wow. For me, I think it comes down to truly learning to own ourselves, own our genius, own our quirky parts, own who we are, because we are all very different. And our differences, assuming we own them, are what can make a difference in other people's lives, are what can make a difference in our lives, in our communities. Anytime I hesitate to say something because I think, oi, how's this going to be taken, or how is this going to land? Every time I do say it and I share it, it always has impact in a positive way. Sometimes I think it's pedantic, or it's, you know, it's like, oh, people know this, but no, they don't know my spin on it. And a lot of people say to me, I don't have anything innovative or anything new. And I go, there is nothing new. It's not about having something new. It's about having your spin on it so that people better understand, better take action. How many times do people say to me, I've heard this before, Isabel, but never like this. And this, the way you've explained, I will take action. That's all I can wish for.
That's just beautiful. Well, I'm going to say thank you, Isabel, very much. I do believe that we could have a lot more conversation and it would go lots of different places.
Anytime.
Anytime.
I can come back.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. You are definitely a treasure, as far as I can tell. And you have definitely owned your genius, and you are definitely making a difference.
Every day. Thank you.
I appreciate that so very much. I appreciate your time in your very busy world. And if anybody wants to find Isabel, she is at www.leapzonestrategies.com. And she'd love to hear from you.
Plenty of tools, free tutorials there to really help you create more impact in the world.
That's amazing. Thank you. So thank you to everyone who is listening. Please subscribe, follow, share. And if you'd like to see what the whole Dyslexic Society is up to, please go to www.thewds.org. And we'd love to hear from you at info at wds.org. I hope you'll join us to hear some more of our speakers and more of the TEDx Bear Creek Park organizing and coaching team. So until next time, take care, stay well, and bye for now.